All right, welcome back, everybody. So let's just pretend we've made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him, and we know a little bit about what that decision looks like, what it's gonna include. One of the things that started to dawn on me, which was, I've got to tell you, a revelation to me, was, I'll just read one little paragraph here. It says, "So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so." I was one of the people who didn't think so. And part of the process of the first three steps started me on a realization that my problems weren't coming at me. They were coming from me. And it was a real shift in perception for me, because the way I thought and how I believed everything was falling in line in the world, I really thought that I had a lot of bad breaks. I really thought I was surrounded by a lot of disingenuous people. I thought that, you know, my lot in life was not offering me the opportunities that I saw maybe some of you having. And I was caught up in this self-defeating belief system. And I started to come to believe that my problems were of my own making. I'm creating all of this mess in the way my mind works. I believe as an alcoholic, I have a mind that wants to kill me. It wants to kill me. I'll just give you a brief example of how this mind would work. I'll give you two examples. One of them was, this is back when I was still drinking. I would come to and lift my head off the pillow, and the immediate thought in my mind was, those bastards! I would immediately go to the latest debacle I was involved with, the latest injustice in my life, and I would start to obsess on that. And then I would go out to my $100 car and drive off to my terrible job, you know, where I had an alcoholic boss. And you know, the whole way I'm thinking, you know, today it's going to suck today. You know, I'm going to go to work and my boss is going to say something. I know he's going to say something. And if he says something, I'm going to say something back. And then we're going to get into it. And then I would probably have to hit him, you know. And then, now I'm going to lose my job. And I'm not going to have any money. And this is what I'm thinking about on the way to work, which is a mile and a half away. you know, so I'm caught up in this stuff. And if I'm not thinking about that, I'm thinking about, you know, the embarrassing and shameful things I have done. I could never get past those. So I'd be like, oh, I can't believe I did that last week. You know, my God, I can never go back there again. I can't believe it. Oh, and this is the bondage of self and how it was manifesting in me. Now I get sober and I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and I got this, right? I got this stuff on me and I'm acting as if I'm not completely insane in my earliest meetings, because I'm very attached to what you would think about me. You know, I don't want you thinking I'm a loser. So I've got to act as if I'm okay with this AA and I'm okay myself. But I'd be sitting in a meeting. I went to a lot of discussion meetings early on because I just didn't know better, and they were the closest ones to my house. Probably the biggest mistake I made in AA was going to all the meetings that were close to my house. And there was this one discussion meeting, and and Every one of these meetings has the guy. You know who I'm talking about? The blowhard. And I'm sitting in this discussion meeting, and the topic is, you know, some crazy thing. And he raises his hand, right? I'm like, oh my God, oh no, he raised his hand. Oh, he raised his hand. Oh, please don't call him. Please. Oh, they called on him. Now I gotta hear this blowhard from talking about his family for 5 minutes. You update us on his Aunt Fanny and Uncle Flood. Oh, yeah. Dude, tell somebody who cares, you know? Oh, God. Oh, he's grateful now. Oh, that warms the cockles of my heart that he's grateful. I think I'll go outside and slash all four of his car tires. And then I'll walk with him outside, out to, you know, after the meeting, you know, just to see how his gratitude holds up. Oh, finally, thank God he's done. Thank God. And I can't let you know that this is the kind of stuff that's going through my head because you throw a net over me. So I'm sitting there like a good AA. Thanks for sharing. you know, there's turmoil in my head early on. Turmoil. And this is the bondage of self that I must be rid of. It will kill me. It will resent me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will resent myself out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It almost happened to me early on. I joined this one home group and, you know, nobody was friendly to me. It was basically because I was going late, leaving early, and not talking to anybody with my head down. You know, those, you know, so the hell with this group, you know. And I go to another group, and that group had the slow, painful group conscience meetings. You know, the contentious, just with people just getting rid, and I was on one side and everybody's on the other. You know, finally I couldn't take it anymore. I'd leave that home group, right? And I end up going to another home group. And in the meantime, I've started working the steps. And this home group I ended up in for 20 years, it I lovingly referred to it as the Somerset Hills High Bottom Group, because it really was. They were all professionals. There'd be a surgeon, you know, a money manager, a lawyer, an airline pilot, and there'd be Chris, the bad electrician, you know, with the $100 car. But that's the group I should have resented myself out of, right? But I'd been exposed to the steps. I'd started the step process. And the step process saved me. You ever see anybody resent themselves out of Alcoholics Anonymous? I know, we all know scores of them. If this stuff isn't addressed, and it isn't addressed early, you know, with a real sense of purpose, as a piece of business, you know, we won't be able to stay. We'll resent ourselves right out of here. So after the third step, it says, next we launched on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. Now, they didn't waste any time back in the day. Okay, when he says launched, a friend of mine's an airline pilot, and he explained what launched means. He says launch is going from 0 to 200 in a matter of feet. You know, that's like what launch is. So it's a good thing. No one among us has really been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles, because I don't know that I launched into a four-step. I meandered into a four-step. But I got to it in time. You know what I mean? I got to it in time. So he starts to use business language. Bill was kind of a failed businessman, and he likes to use analogies that will make sense to the most amount of people. So he talks about a business inventory, and he talks about, you know, what you have up on your shelves. So let's say you own a shoe store, and all the shoes you have are like old, and they haven't sold, and they're not in style anymore, but you're gonna hang on to those shoes, because damn it, I'm not sending them back. I'm going to wait until somebody buys them. If you have that type of attitude, your shoe store is going to close. You have to keep good you know, you have to keep good control over the inventory. I think I need to keep good control over my emotional and spiritual inventory. And remember, I've got a mind that wants to kill me. This is important work. My mind wants me to be so uncomfortably in self that the only thing that is an answer for relief and a vacation from the pain of that self is alcohol. So I've got to find another way. Now, it moves us immediately into a resentment inventory, which I think is appropriate. I think it's the absolute perfect place for me to start because I am pissed. My life, I'm living at home with mom and I'm 33. My wife and family left me 10 years ago when I needed of them the most. I've got a terrible job and a terrible car, and they've made me walk so many times because of my DUIs, it's ridiculous. And my life really is pathetic. I can't go to a class reunion, you know. Hey, Chris, how are you doing? What are you up to? Well, me and mom, you know, we're hanging out and I'm doing a lot of, so I was upset about my lot in life. And I blamed it on you. I blamed it on you. It would have been inconvenient for me to take responsibility for all this stuff. I was like the guy who got the DUI because the mechanic forgot to fix the taillight. I didn't want to take responsibility for any of this stuff. And I'm pissed. I'm pissed at a lot of people, a lot of places, and a lot of things. So they call it a grudge list in here. And they also say resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Why does it destroy more alcoholics than anything else? Because it cuts us off from the sunlight of the spirit. We wither like a weed that's been poisoned and we die. That's just what happens with this resentment. I can't tell you how many, I go to this beginner's meeting, and I still go. It was one of the first meetings I go to. I never name the meeting because it's not really appropriate, but it's the Basking Ridge Monday night beginner's meeting. And here's the format for the meeting. There's 100, 120 people in there some nights, right? And the format is, anyone with less than 90 days, we want you to share. They even call on you. And you get to share first. And then it goes from 90 days to 6 months and 6 months to a year. And I get to watch the transition of toxic selfishness in this meeting. When the people with less than 90 days are sharing, your hair is blown back by the selfishness and self-centeredness. My parents are cutting my allowance off, and my girlfriend's not talking to me, and blah, 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 me, I. Thank you. You know? And then the people with 90 days to 6 months, you know, I'm working with my sponsor, you know, and he's got some good things to say, you know, but... And then you go from 6 months to a year. And it's like, you know, I did this inventory and I'm really starting to see some stuff. And then the people with more than a year get to share their experience, strength, and hope. And all of a sudden the air clears. And I get to see the transition that we go through. If we're, you know, consistent with meeting attendance and sponsorship, I get to see this beautiful transition away from this toxic selfishness and self-centeredness. Now, I love the list. There's an economy to this work that gets missed by a lot of alcoholics because we've had therapy and we've read all the self-help books and we've done the Tony Robbins seminars and we've explored our wounded inner child, you know, for 3 years. And we've done all this stuff so that the economy of this stuff can sometimes be elusive. But his whole resentment inventory is this big. It's like less than 100 words. This is the stuff that could kill him, right? And I love how it's laid out. And I want to just call attention to one person. Mr. Brown, okay? All right, what's the cause of the resentment? His attentions to my wife. Mr. Brown is hitting on this dude's wife. Told my wife about my mistress. What? We don't do that, guys, do we? That's low. Brown may get my job at the office. So he works with this guy, and the guy's trying to take his job, trying to take his wife, trying to screw up his affair, and trying to take his job. Then you skip down to his wife. He's mad at his wife. And it says, she likes Brown. And she wants the house put in her name. So Brown is going for the house now. Now, I don't know about you, but no one's ever come at me that hard. You know what I mean? No one has ever come at me that hard. And Bill is saying, these are the kind of resentments we have to get over. We have to get over these or they kill us. Now, I've worked with a lot of guys. And a lot of them, you know, have these resentments that they're really unwilling to look at. And as a sponsor, it's my job to help move them into a willingness to see these as deadly, to see these resentments as deadly. They're not justifiable. They're deadly. To see them as deadly and to get them ready to face these resentments, at least in an inventory form. And another thing that was really interesting for me was I got an understanding of resentments through this inventory. I can't be mad at anything unless it's harming, threatening, or interfering with what I want, or harming, threatening, and interfering with what I have. There's no win for the sale without something like that, right? So by going a little bit deeper, that's deeper than I ever went, you know, looking at really what it affects. Going deeper, I started to see the nature of these resentments. And when I put pen to paper, there were a lot of them that were made up in my mind. They say fancy to real resentments. A lot of these resentments were just my mind. Remember I told you how my mind worked? I'm going to go to work, and then he's going to say this, and he's going to say that. I mean, I could go into these tangents and develop a resentment against you when I haven't even talked to you, you know? Fancy to real. So being honest, being truthful, trying to be as accurate as possible when I'm writing these things down was really, really important for me. I believe there are things that are blocking me off from a connection with the divine, a connection to the power, a connection to God, a connection to the Father of Light, a connection to the great reality. There's a million ways to describe that experience. But I think that there's a lot of things that block me off. Don't give me a chance to engage. Doesn't allow me the ability to form relationship with the divine and you and me and the world. And these resentments are the number one thing I think that block me off. There's a great line in the 12 and 12, and it confused me for years. And I'm not as good as Steve at quoting them because I've got the ADHD, DDHHD. But it says something like this. It says, defective relationships were almost always the cause of our immediate woes, including our alcoholism. And Steve was talking about relationships is everything, right? Resentment is certainly the number one offender to those relationships, at least in my case. And it has to be dealt with. I've got to get to a place where all is well in my world. I just do. Because that's the best place for me to be, to make this connection, to have this connection with God. And I think what I'll do is, if it's okay, I'll pass it over to you.
Thanks, Chris. Hey, everybody. You know, Chris has really laid it out and got us to that point in the inventory of self-examination, right? We were talking in the last session that self in its various manifestations is what has defeated me. It wasn't alcohol that defeated me. Self is what has defeated me. So we look for its common manifestations, and then it says resentment's the number one offender. Apparently, at least percentage-wise, resentment is the number one manifestation of self. It destroys more alcoholics than anything. And while I believe that's true in the collective, I will tell you that for me, fear is the number one offender. And of course, fear, as you see in our book, is attached to almost all the resentments as well. So I don't know that is even a challenge. I'll be talking about the fear inventory in a minute because we want to touch all three of the bases. Usually when you're at something like this, resentment gets all the press because it's the number one offender. When we talk about it in our meetings, it's almost always the resentment part, and I think probably appropriately. But so Chris got us all the way here to this self-examination. If self is what has defeated me, then I'm going to do some self-examination. I'm going to take a look at self. And I'm going to go into these resentments and into the inventory, look to see where self has manifested. But the first part of the inventory is really kind of self-indulgent. I've been doing it for years. Make a list of people that you're pissed at. Oh, I got one already. I mean, and the truth is, you know, I didn't show up at AA. I'm kind of felt like one of those guys who didn't think he resented a lot of people. Because I'm not a yeller or a screamer. I was more than feeling like I had resentments. I was quietly disappointed in the world and its people. And which is, by the way, we talked about over in the third step, that one of the things that is necessary is for me to quit playing God. It doesn't work. And one of the ways I play God is to think I know how things ought to be. And so I look out and I'm constantly disappointed in you and the way things are. Later in the 12 and 12, it says we will see, one of the things that I will pull from this step work is that it says we will see that we've been making unreasonable demands upon our fellows, ourselves, and upon God. So you disappoint me, I disappoint me, and God disappoints me. If you're keeping score, there's no one left to be disappointed in. Everybody has let me down. And I don't think about that consciously. That's why I have to do this self-examination to go look for these underlying things that I don't recognize normally. And so, you know, I get a list of, you know, my sponsor said, because I'm wrestling with this frustration, I mean, with this resentment and wondering if I have them, but he said, start with the acute and the obvious. The 12 and 12 uses that language, and I decided my mother was acute and my brother was obvious, and I put them down. But he said, also think about people who frustrate you, who've disappointed you, who've let you down. Because that is a resentment when I just attach different labels to it. And that helped me grow this list. But again, I get to list these people, and then I get to do a column that tells you what they did to me. My view of what they did to me. And I've been doing that on bar stools forever. I've been talking about them and what they did, and I've been talking about what it affects, right? Here's that SOB. Here's what he did. He's getting in my pocketbook. He's messing, telling my wife I got a mistress. This Mr. Brown dude, like the T-shirt says, needs his ass kicked, right? But all of that is self indulgent. And then you change the game on me again. Now you say, okay, but now let's look at that list from an entirely different angle. When I write it down, it's a grudge list. You know, my sponsor says, don't try to talk yourself out of it. Be mad. It's a grudge list. We were burned up. So I got the list. But now how about look at it from an entirely different angle? Well, what's that angle? And see, my sponsor didn't spend a ton of time trying to help me determine, as Chris said, whether this column two, whether what they did to me was real or imagined, whether I was accurate. I don't know about you guys, when I call my sponsor with something, I explain it to him in agonizing detail. Because we want to explain it in such a way that he or she truly understands. And my first sponsor, Frank, had really poor phone skills. And he would just stop me and say, "Hey, Steve," he said, "let's just assume you're right. Now what?" I want to relitigate. I constantly want to relitigate. And if I forgive you, I give up the right to keep, you know, litigating the, you know, I want to be the prosecuting attorney. And I want to continue the prosecution, and I will build my case around the fact that my facts are right. And I want to keep focusing on the facts when what we're doing is focusing on the resentment. And the feeling is that I can't be okay until Chris talked about it, but you know, we'll visit again when we get to the 10th step, at least in the 12 and 12, and it talks about the spiritual axiom that whenever I'm disturbed, no matter the cause, there's something wrong with me. And that used to bother me a lot. I don't know about it, because again, it felt like one more time you're blaming me for what's going on out here. But really, I think what's being said is whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. And what's wrong with me is I'm disturbed. And the solution is to be undisturbed. And the illusion is that the way for me to be undisturbed is to reconcile these external circumstances to my satisfaction. When this isn't happening anymore, when you have apologized or when you treat me differently, when things change, then I can be okay. And the simple truth is, though it's not easy to get to and I'm not always willing to accept it, is that now's the time that I can be okay the moment I'm willing to be okay, the moment that I give up that judgment, the moment that and again, I don't mean to live in a circumstance that's untenable or abusive. I'm not talking about that, but we were having a similar conversation in a meeting one day, and a woman was going through a divorce, and she had a restraining order on her husband, and she said he's coming, and the topic was forgiveness, and she said he's coming every night and standing at the head of their driveway and screaming obscenities at the house and talking about the kids and talking about her in front of the kids. And he said, "How do you forgive that when that's going on?" And I said, "Well, you know," I talked to her afterwards. I didn't say it in the meeting, but I said, "You know, you can forgive someone and get a restraining order at the same time. You can deal with the circumstances, but do it with a peace of mind and a forgiving heart." And that seems incongruent, but it is when it's just me. But when I invite God into the circumstances, that opportunity's there. And so this entirely different angle says, what if they too are spiritually sick? What if, because it says I could no more be free of these resentments than I could alcohol. So I get here and powerlessness has presented itself again. Apparently I don't have any more power over resentment than I do alcohol. You don't seem to be able to talk me out of having a resentment. You can give me good information and good reasons, but I seem to be stuck with it sometimes. But it says, so what's our course to be? It says, here's our course. We're going to look at it from a different angle. When you put this down, you are coming at it from the injured person, from those son of a guns, from a grudge list. But now let's take a look and think maybe perhaps they are spiritually sick, like ourselves. So I begin to see these people not as different than me, but like me. People like us don't get here without hurting some people along the way. We've done it, and we might not have done what they did to us. You know, we read over in the third step, it says, admitting we are somewhat at fault, we're sure others are more to blame. And I'll hang my hat on that. And this is saying, we'll get to it in a minute, but setting aside the wrongs of others completely, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. So the game changes here once I've gotten these three columns, it says that's when I invite God into this process. And I ask God to help me show pity, patience, and tolerance that I would gladly grant a sick friend. And I ask God, how can I be helpful to this person? Nothing is more counterintuitive than for me to think, how could I be helpful to this person that I'm feeling this resentment towards? And then it says, while we cannot be helpful to everyone, at least, so that tells me at a minimum, maybe I'll come out with this, at least God will help me to show a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. How can I take a more kind and more tolerant perspective of the people of whom I'm, or even institutions and principles that I may resent? And I can't do it of my own will, but if I invite God into this process again, honestly, truly, humbly, but see, I don't want to give up my right to be angry. I want to keep talking about column two. I want to keep talking about what you did. You know, I watched the CIS, you know, there was CIS, then there was CIS Miami, then there was CIS New York, and then you got NCIS, which is going to run forever, obviously. And but I watch them, and they all start the same. Within that first scene, somewhere there's going to be a dead body, and NCIS team is called to the scene. And in this particular episode, let's say a car has driven off of a cliff, fallen hundreds of feet down into a ravine where it hit and smashed and exploded into flames. So the body is mangled and burned, and to all external evidence, it was either the fall or the fire that killed the person in this car. But that's not sufficient for the CIS team. They take the body back to the lab, and they do an autopsy. They cut and go in. And when they go in, they discover that there was a massive heart attack that caused him to drive off the cliff, that caused the crash, that caused the fire. Now, I will tell you that step two, that column two in my inventory is the external evidence. And it happened. The fall happened, the crash happened, the fire happened. The facts are right. But I didn't go far enough, and now I'm being asked to do a spiritual autopsy, to go in and take a look at the cause of my resentment, not whether what they did or didn't do was right or wrong. Why do I feel the way I feel around this? And how can I be free of that feeling? And again, so that's when I invite God in, right? And we do what we call the sick man's prayer. You know, a lot of people talk about the prayer in the back of the book in Freedom from Bondage, and she talks about praying for them for 2 weeks or longer, and that's good. I do it, and I think it's good advice. But first, I need some power I don't have to do something I can't do, which is invite God into this to help me show a kindly and tolerant view. How can I look at this person differently? Perhaps they too are spiritually sick, and now we've got a common ground to get on. And only then do I seem to be able to do what it encourages me to do next, which is setting aside the wrongs of others. So now I just throw column two and three away. They're no longer important to the process. That was just the way you reeled me in. So now setting aside the wrongs of others completely, setting aside column two completely, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Now that, to me, doesn't mean that I'm looking in this relationship and see where I'm at fault for everything, but I do at least want to look for, in this relationship or in any relationships, have I lied in this relationship? Have I been resentful in this relationship? Have I acted out of fear any time? Not about what I put in column two. Almost everybody in here has got a parent somewhere on their inventory. You're going to tell me you never lied to your parent? Of course you did. You can't survive your teens and not lie to your parents. Have I ever resented them? Yeah. Or a spouse, or a sibling, or an employer. And so I moved all that stuff and I take a look at me and say, yeah. Yeah. Now, admitting I'm somewhat at fault, I'm sure others are more to blame. I still want to keep going back and relitigating what they've done to me. And this is just asking me, Now, but we're just looking at you, Steve. Have you lied? Have you acted out of fear? Have you been resentful? Have you been dishonest? And I just want to look for those and own them where I have, and later I get a chance to go to the, you know, if you steal $5,000 from me and I steal $50 from you, my mind says that you owe me $4,950. But this is saying I got to forget the $5,000 and I got to deal with the $50 I stole. Whatever that is. And that's the look we get to take there. And it is freeing if I'm willing to do it, and I can get past getting hung up, relitigating what you did to me. Forgiveness feels like, forgiveness doesn't feel this way. My resistance to forgiveness seems to be based on, if I forgive you, you win. If I forgive this, and forgiveness isn't me giving you absolution, me coming to you and saying, you know what, lucky you, I forgive. The forgiveness is just my heart opening back up and not being held captive to those hard feelings. I want to be light-hearted in my recovery, and I'm stuck there sometimes. So that's what I find there. And then I want to move into the fear inventory and throw it back to Chris some for that. And then I promised you some sex discussion. And to be truthful, it takes longer to talk about it than the act itself. But at any rate, I was 6 years sober before I realized I had not, well, before I realized there was a fear inventory. And I certainly hadn't done one. And I was at a weekend like this, though the two people doing it were far superior to me and Chris. And actually it was Don P. and Gary B. And they were talking about this inventory, and they were talking about some stuff I hadn't done. And I didn't know I hadn't done it, and I don't blame anybody for why I hadn't done it. And I meant to bring with me, because I often do, March the 6th of 1997 was the first inventory, fear inventory I ever did, and I've got it. I still show it to guys all the time, and I've done a lot of fear inventory since. And the fear inventory's been the most freeing for me, the most informative and the most freeing, because I didn't recognize, I mean, I knew I was afraid, but I wasn't always putting that label on it, but I didn't understand it. And so our book says look, I'm not a guy that gets into the debate around the mechanics of inventory. I'm not going to argue about whether this is the resentment inventory is a 3-column or a 4-column or even a 5-column inventory. I look down here after it gives us the example. It says nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. If I'm honest and thorough, we're probably going to get somewhere. If I'm not honest and thorough, it doesn't matter what my technique is. It doesn't matter how many columns I've got if there's BS in the column. So just trying to find my way to this stuff. But over here in the fear inventory, it says when dealing with our fears, we put them on paper. That's not complicated, but starting to write them was kind of daunting. And that first fear inventory, I've got it, and I've got the fears that I've heard, you know, 1,000 people give, and many of them are the same. I had a fear of success and a fear of failure. I had to fear what people think of me. I had a fear at my job that they'd figure out I didn't know what I was doing, that I'm in my office pretending like I know what I'm doing. And the truth is, so is everybody else. Everybody closes their offices and goes, how the hell did I get here, you know? And the thing is, we probably wouldn't be in that office if we weren't up to the job, but we're always that ego, that fear, that self-centered fear, which is at the root of my trouble, drives me. It says, in dealing with our fears, we put them on paper, right? And then it says, we ask ourselves why we had these fears. It's kind of a rhetorical question in the book, because the book answers it. It says, isn't it because self, I'm back to this self-examination, isn't because self-reliance failed us? And I wasn't quite sure what that read good, but I don't quite know what it means. But I go on and read it. It says, we think there's a better way than self-reliance. In the third, and it says we're living on a different basis. Am I? What is that different basis? Well, my goodness, just three pages over, I got on my knees and said, God, I offer myself to thee. To build with me and do with me. I'm living on the basis of trusting infinite God rather than my finite self. And so my fear is when I am self-reliant. And this is what that looks like to me. That my fears are that something's going to be T-O-O something. It's going to be too hard. I'm going to be too poor. I'm going to be too old. I'm going to be too lonely. I'm going to be too embarrassed. It's going to be more than I can handle. Whatever happens is going to be more than I can handle. And the book says, you're right, it is. That's why I'm inviting God into this. When I am self-reliant, depending on me rather than depending on God, I am afraid, and I should be. I'm incompetent to handle these things, but when I trust, so I'm inviting, am I really inviting God into these situations? I read that, I had a whole list of these fears, and again, some of the things I'm sharing with you now weren't apparent to me as I'm doing that first inventory. But what did become apparent to me in that first fear inventory as I wrote them down, because I've got written in real time, I wrote a little box around it, that all of a sudden I noticed that there was a lot of self-pity in my fear inventory. Now, self-pity is one of the defects of character that, you know, it's just not very sexy. I'd like to have a lust problem, if at all possible. Self-pity is kind of a weenie problem to have. But it was, and I'll tell you how I know, and I've had guys do this. Sometimes grab one of your inventories and read it with a whiny voice. I'm thinking, I'm afraid of success. I'm afraid of failure. You know, and it's not to make fun of those things, and I never make light of somebody else, but I realize how much self-pity is in there that, oh, this can't be happening to me. Oh, this won't be okay. I won't be okay. And I got this whole list that my fears, this whole list of things that I don't even know I've decided are can't happen. And as I said, I think earlier this morning, in a way, that's me breaking my covenant with the third step. Because in the third step, I said, do with me as you will. My fear inventory is full of stuff that can't happen to me. And so I have not really turned that over. And what I used to think I was hearing from people is that if you have enough faith, everything will turn out okay. If you're prayerful, if you're faithful, if you're a good AA doobie, if your meeting attendance is good, you're sponsoring people, check the boxes, you know, and that the reward will be God will give you what you want. But my experience has been more that it's not that I'll be okay, or that everything will work out okay. It said I'll be okay no matter how things work out. And my preferences begin to disappear. My demands begin to lighten up a little bit. My requirements, my target for happiness gets bigger. What if I can only be okay if a few, you know, that bullseye really gets small sometimes, the demands I make on the world for me to be okay. You know, what if you went to Baskin Robbins and they got 32 flavors, right? And you say, just give me whatever you think I'd like. But if I'm bound and determined on Tutti Frutti and they're out of Tutti Frutti that day, I'm screwed. But what if I'm okay with vanilla? What if I'm okay with chocolate? What if I'm okay with these various things? What if I'm okay? I'm sitting in a meeting, and this is when I'll give it back to you, Chris. I was less than 60 days sober. And man, everything was blowing my mind, you know. I mean, I was just attracted right away. I really was to the things I was hearing in AA. And there was a brand new guy in there. And I mean, literally beat up. And we did what we do in meetings a lot. Everybody's, you know, when you're 60 days sober, nothing you love better than a brand new guy. Because, Jesus, I'll start talking to him instead of me. And everybody was encouraging, right? And they gave a little pitch and said, keep coming back. It gets better. The next person shared and said, keep coming back, man, it gets better. And that went 3, 4, 5 people all in their little pitch with keep coming back, it gets better. There's an old guy named Herb in there, and Herb woke up just long enough to share with us, and he said, I'll tell you when it gets better, goddammit. It gets better when it's okay the way that it is. And man, my head was spinning like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, you know. I'm trying to figure, what the hell did he just say, man? And I can't figure it out, but I'm driving home, you know, and I'm telling you, 32 years later, I can hear him say it just like he's saying it this morning. And what he was saying is it gets better right now. We spend so much time talking about living a day at a time. So much time talking about living in the moment. Well, this is it. And I keep getting ready to have a good day. When this happens, it gets better when it's okay the way that it is. And that's available to me, but it means the destruction of self-centeredness. Chris.
Thanks, Steve. You know, may you find him now. I mean, think about that. May you find him now, not after a bunch of work, or not after church, you know, may you find him now. Now, fear. Fear was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of my existence was shot through with it. It created circumstances that blew up my life in 1,300 different ways. But I didn't recognize it. It manifested in me like low to high level anxiety. Like, I just didn't want to be right here, right now, with you. I wanted to be somewhere else. I always was uncomfortable with myself and my environment. And I look back, it took multiple fear inventories, really, for me to dig deep enough. But I look back and I look at how fear corroded the quality of my life in a million ways. I had an unbelievable fear of speaking in public in school. I'm talking, you know, first grade through high school. There'd be a responsibility to give an oral report on something. And rather than get up in front of class and take the chance of looking stupid, I would cut school that day and a couple more days after just to be sure I'm missing the makeup. Okay? John and I were talking about this morning. They had square dancing in gym class. You know, it was not okay for me. Because what they would do is they would line you up on one side of the gym, all the guys, line up all the girls on one side of the gym, and then blow the whistle, and you had to run across the gym and ask a girl to dance. That was traumatic for me. You know, what if they say no, and I get shamed, and I have to go home and kill myself? So all this stuff, the fabric of my life's existence was just negatively impacted by this anxiety or fear, whatever you want to call it, from an early, early age. And then I start adulting. You know, we all have to start adulting at one point in time or another, like getting jobs. And you know, I'd be afraid to try for a job, or I'd be afraid to ask for a raise, because if I was denied, I'd have to quit. And, you know, I in personal relationships, I was afraid of being honest. I was afraid to let you know, like, what I was really like, so I chameleoned, you know? I tried to come off as I think you would want me to come off, because I was afraid of, if you saw the authentic me, you'd feel about me like I do, which is not too good. And And this is like devastating for a quality of life. But if you would have walked up to me the day I walked into AA and said, Chris, fear is a real big problem in your life, we would have had a problem. Because I would have had to prove to you that I was not a coward. But that's not the way fear impacted the quality of my life. It was more under the horizon. Like was I daring? Was I reckless? Would I fight somebody that called me out? Would I drive a motorcycle, you know, as fast as I could? Would I jump off bridges? I'd do all these daring things that looked like, you know, the John Wayne kind of courage. So I didn't recognize this as fear. I didn't know what it was. I just knew I just didn't want to be right here, right now with you. This isn't working for me. You know, I'm just going to exit. And that's really the impact fear had on my life. You know, I heard one speaker way back when, one of the greats, he used to say, folks, all I ever wanted to do was step out easy. Be able to step out easy. And that's not something I could ever do. There were always problems and I'm worrying, you know, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And I need to inventory these fears. I need to come to terms with this self-centered fear. It's all based in self. And it's true that all resentments have some form of fear attached to them. Because I can't be mad at a person, a place, or an institution without having fear of you know what had happened or what's gonna happen, and it was another evolution for me to come to terms with just the destruction that this fear had. Now, how do you get rid of something that's so ingrained in your character, in your emotional state? You know, somebody can't just come up to me and say, hey, Chris, just stop worrying. Just stop worrying. Don't worry about it. That, it's so deep within me that I think the only power that's going to be sufficient to make a change in my life is this power they call God. It's just, there's nothing else. I can't read the book, you know, Getting Rid of Fear for Dummies. Because it's almost not really an intellectual exercise. It's a spiritual exercise. To start moving away from this fear. There's some promises in here when they're going through the fear inventory. We're now at the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We made a decision to do that in the third step. So he's assuming we meant it. We're trusting and relying upon God. It says we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely upon him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. So there's got to be engagement with this relationship, with this power greater than myself, for this stuff to work. And to the exact extent that I play the role God assigns, and try to do what I believe he would have me do, I believe that puts me in the atmosphere where I can match the calamity with serenity. I can start to step out easy a little bit. There's a lot more work that really I had to do for this to really start to work for us, for me. But probably one of the greatest benefits that I got from Alcoholics Anonymous and my engagement in Alcoholics Anonymous is a relief of this anxiety, of this self-centered fear. And it's not only enabled me to match calamity with serenity, it's enabled me to do the things that I never would have even wanted to do before I got sober. There's a lot of things that I would just say no to, you know. Somebody would suggest something, no, that's not for me. You know, you guys go ahead. There's like a million of those things. That once this fear starts to, you start to outgrow this fear, you start to say yes to. And then the world becomes a different place to live in. You know, my world was so small toward the end of my drinking. It was so tiny. And it didn't include very much at all. And it existed all up here, you know, in my head. And over the course of the years, engaging with all of the meetings, the steps, the service, the sponsorship, what has happened is I've become willing to engage in things that I used to be very, very afraid to do. I had a huge fear of people and crowds, and I always wanted to be on the outside. I always felt I was on the outside, and that would make me want to be on the outside. I never could fit in with the group. I can never feel like that, you know, I'm a part of, or I'm connected to, or I'm in unity with. And this reductionist fear has gotten me to the point where I just I'm okay with stepping out easy and doing things that, I would have been in, you become the kind of person you wouldn't have even liked when you first came in. You know what I mean? And you know, I'm so grateful for the power of this inventory. And I'm so grateful for the intuition, that Bill and Hank and the people that put this book together had. I mean, did they put their finger on the problem and the solution in the best way possible? Listen, I've gone through this book without exaggeration probably 600 times. You know, in all the workshops and working with people and the studies that I've listened to and everything. And practically every time I go through it, something jumps out at me at a deeper level. It hits me at a level it's never hit me before. And this year, where this book is really hitting me is on a mystical level. It's a mystical level of, and you know what I mean by that is some of the terminology in this book is mystical. Self had defeated us. The Father of Light, the great reality, a power greater than ourselves. All this terminology, there's tons of it in here. It's really on a mystical level. And Bill is what, 4 years sober? 5 years sober when this book gets put together? It's amazing to me. And you know what the mystics were? Or they were people who went all in. They went deep. They were the people you'd find in the Himalayas, in the caves, you know, sitting there meditating, you know, up in the caves. Or they'd be the people who'd go on the 1 year long silent retreats at Gethsemane or you know, with Thomas Merton. These are the people who had an inner drive for a connection to the divine that pushed away everything else and they went all in. And they put on the robe and they started the disciplines of whatever to get a deeper experience with God. You know, I believe the alcoholic to a degree is an unresolved mystic. I think within us, Steve touched on some of this already, I believe within us is a desperate need to connect with the divine and be in unity with the divine. And I think that desperate need pushed us into all kinds of crazy sprees. Certainly our alcoholism, but drug addiction, the way we've approached sex and gambling and money and all these forms of externals to get us to feel connected and in unity with internally. And this book is saying we find this great reality, the connection and the unity, we find it within. We clear away all the crap and it's already here. Like Steve said, it's already here. We just need to move the baggage away. And fear and resentment are two of the great, and guilt and shame and remorse are another bunch of them, you know, are the sex inventory. So what I'll do is if you want, I'll pass it over to you because you promised everybody sex.
Christian made me think when he said, I promised everybody sex, that many of you have probably heard that an AA meeting is in many, many ways like an orgy, that when you leave, you realize you've had a really good time, but you don't know who to thank. So that leads us into now about sex, right? And you know, and I did want to have this conversation because we often don't, and it's a can be a challenging one to have because it's such a personal, private part of our lives, and nothing can turn a room full of grown-ups like us into junior high school kids like that conversation, because that's kind of the way we respond to those things, because to look at it in the eye sometimes is daunting. But again, I think the point I want to make up front is that, at least from my perspective, AA is not examining my behavior. It is not, as it says, we're not the arbiter of anyone's sex life. So it is not trying to determine whether what I've done is a right thing or a wrong thing in terms of behavior. It is, I'm encouraged to examine that like we have these other areas of our lives to see, is it selfish? Is anybody getting hurt? Is it arousing jealousy, bitterness, or suspicion? Is it dishonest? Is there something I could have or should have done instead? It is examining the relationship to seeing those things. It's not saying you should or should not do this or that. A few of the things that comfort me coming into the conversation is, first Bill writes that, we all have sex problems. You know, there's some things in the book where he writes in the past tense, we used to do this or used to do that, and I don't know if it's on purpose or not, but here he says, and he's talking about the first 100 initially, right? He said, look, we all got sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. And then I'm further comforted a little later on when it says, we treat sex like we would any other problem. So it's not some special category in terms of how we respond to those. But I do think because it is so personal and so private, and we tend to ourselves sometimes attach shame or guilt or around that, or someone else has put that on us, shame or guilt. So I'd just rather keep this back here. I'll put everything else in the game, but I don't want to put this in the game, you know, and it's a challenging thing sometimes to look at. And when it says we all have sex problems, I just choose to, you know, I know I am casting a wide net, but I'm just going to go on and say that I think that means that everybody in here has sex problems. We don't all have them at the same time. And they don't look the same with everybody, and they're different at different times. We tend to think about this initially in terms of misbehavior, right? I mean, misbehavior in quotation marks. Maybe, as our book calls, a little reckless romancing, even though I might be in a committed relationship or a marriage. And certainly, that's included in there. But sex problems can extend into how do I view this area of my life? It's a God-given instinct that we've already talked about. And it says that our sex, that this is not to be used lightly or selfishly, but it's important. It's important, and it's more important to some people than others. But back in the 12 and 12, in the 12th step, it talks about that there'll come a time that every sound human being we want to have the deepest possible union with someone in the areas of physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional. So the physical makes the top four. You know, now I will tell you, I spent a lot more time focused on the physical rather than the spiritual, mental, and emotional before I got here. You know, back in that 12th step, it's only a couple of pages over that the conversation that we are all used to hearing where it says when boy meets girl on AA campus that problems arise. And it says they should be well enough established. I think that means both in their recovery, but also maybe with each other. That in the areas of mental, spiritual, and emotional, their compatibility, that they are compatible and it's not wishful thinking. And it doesn't even mention physical when boy meets girl on AA campus, because Bill's figuring, okay, they already laid up with each other, and now they'll try to figure out that mental, spiritual, and emotional stuff later. Because we get carried away right away, and boom, and we don't pay attention to those things. But then sometimes we can be in these relationships, or we can either how we treat sex, how sex impacts me, and potentially how my feelings or behavior impact others around that. It can not be about having a lot of sex. It could be about having none. It could be about being so uncomfortable or so having such strong emotion around that I can't find a way to enjoy this part of this God-given instinct. And there's not a right amount or wrong amount or right kind. I'm telling you, AA doesn't care and how much sex you have or who you have it with or how many of you they're having it or what gender you are or what you're wearing or any. AA just does not care. But what I'm looking for is what we started this whole inventory looking for is what is blocking me off from my relationship with God and my relationship with you. Is some of this stuff getting in the way? And that's all not, you know, and it says that God alone can judge my sex conduct. And thank goodness the book says that opinions may run to extremes in AA. You want some extreme advice, you know, just ask your AA home group. I got a couple of thoughts about sex. Who'd like to weigh in? You're going to get a whole cross-section of ideas, just like, you know, you guys might leave here with absolutely, you know, dismissing anything that I say. Doesn't fall into your wheelhouse. That's okay. But it's not about the activity. It's like everything else, it's the inside job that I have to take a look sometimes. So I will tell you that you heard me talk about the fact that there were some infidelities in my marriage before I got sober. And then I got sober and I straightened out. And it wasn't hard. I mean, I began, for 8 years, I'm doing good. And then I ended up, my brother and I took some guys out to dinner one night. And it was a business thing, and it became clear in the dinner that these guys would like to go to a gentleman's club. Now, if anything has ever been misnamed, it's the gentleman's club. But anyway, we get up. My brother and I. My brother's paying the check. He comes over to me. He says, "Steve, I know this isn't your thing, man." He said, and it wasn't his thing either. But he said, "But I'll take them." And I went, "I'll go." And so we go, right. And then these guys came back into town about a month later, and we went again. And then I started going just to see if they were there, And now I'm just a heartbeat from being on the Jerry Springer show, you know, and I start going, right? And I'm doing this 3 or 4 months, and it turned into a pretty regular thing, and I'm sneaking into my own house, and I'm, I'm just doing a, you know, just all the associated things around this that were making me a liar and all of this stuff. But I go to my sponsor because, and I hadn't told him, you don't want to tell him too early. And I said, Frank, this is what I'm doing, man. And I feel guilty about it. And this is the point I want to make. Frank said, he said, well, Steve-O, he said, either quit feeling guilty or quit going. I don't care which. Because, see, he wasn't telling me whether that, I'm sure he had an opinion, but he wasn't telling me whether that was a right or a wrong thing to do. He said, but since you feel guilty, let's do an inventory on this. Let's look at it. And you will either discover if there's something that doesn't work for you, or you will find freedom to go without the guilt. And he was uninvested in putting his opinion on there. He wanted me to me and God to figure out, where does that fit with me? And we start doing the inventory, and I begin answering the questions, right? Is it selfish? Well, clearly it's selfish, but not so much I can't handle it. Is it dishonest? Yes, dishonest. Because I'm not telling my wife and daughter where I'm going. I'm spending money. You know, during the time when money was tight for us, I can promise you our budget didn't have a line item for strippers. So I'm manipulating that, but maybe I can handle that. But I get down to the question that says, are you arousing jealousy, bitterness, or suspicion? And the answer was absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because I'd won back the entire trust of my wife and daughter. They weren't questioning where I was, and I was out late some. They weren't, there was absolutely not one bit of suspicion around that. And that is what I discovered I wasn't going to be able to live with. I wasn't going to be able to stay sober and do this. Now, I couldn't have told you on the front end of that inventory that that's what I was going to find. And that's been true of most of my inventory work, that I think I know what's going on, and then I do that spiritual autopsy, and I discover something other than what I thought was going to be at the root of my problem. Now, that was just my experience. We go on and we find things. Guys come to, you know, I'll have guys ask about pornography, you know, and that's, you know, something that there's, you know, everybody has, you know, and I show up here with no opinion about that, no expressed opinion about it. But I say, look, man, I'm not telling you whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, a right thing or a wrong thing. What I'm asking you is it impacting your relationship with your wife or with your, you know, significant other? Is it impacting your relationship with God? Sandy Beach said, I was privileged to go on this walk with Sandy. This had been about 15, 18 years ago at the first Far Corners retreat that he put on. And I was a little disappointed in me about something I'd been doing, and I end up on this walk with, did you ever go to that Far Corners retreat? Anyway, they had this Prayer St. Francis walk, and you would go, there was a station that would have one of the verses to the Prayer St. Francis, and you stop and contemplate, talk about that, go to the next one. Well, Bob B. and Sandy B. invited me to go on this walk with them, and these are just Mount Rushmore guys for me, right? And I'm on that walk, and I'm talking about, again, some stuff I'm disappointed in me about. And Sandy goes, because he'd given a 6 and 7 talk that had just gone over my head. You know, I mean, it was just, and I'm trying to find the balance between personal responsibility and God removing this defect of character. Where do I act better before God makes me better? Is kind of the way I was framing it. And Sandy said, we're walking, and he said, well, Steve, he said, let's take pornography. He said, how do most guys watch pornography? And I said, well, I don't know, Sandy. I said, I've heard that, what I've heard is that, and he said, well, how do most guys, he said, lots of times somebody goes in the room, closes the door and locks it. Maybe closes the blinds, you know, turns on the computer. Do whatever they do, and they've left God on the other side of that door. And then, come out, open the door, and go, okay, God, here I am. I'm back. Let's go out into the... And, but they've excluded God from this area of your life. He says, what I'm telling you is, Steve, next time you get ready to watch pornography, he said, invite God to go with you. I said, Sandy, I got to be honest with you, brother. I said, that's not the menage a trois I had in mind. And, but what he was saying was, he said, if you will earnestly and honestly invite God into this part of your life, he says that you will find your way, that things will fall away that need to fall away. But you got to really, that's that humbly ask, as we will talk about when we get to 6 and 7. And again, it's not pornography being a good or a bad thing. It's not any of these other things. It's not what you may or may not be doing. I'll tell you one last thing. My wife cringes when she's cringing at everything I've said so far. But I did a men's retreat one weekend, and a guy came up to me toward the end of the weekend. He said, "Aren't you afraid Connie's going to hear that?" I said, "She ain't listening to 6 hours of me talking to pick up one thing. You know, she's not going to." But you know, one of the sex problems I might have today is that. In our relationship at our age and stuff that we now, you know, there's not a lot of spontaneous sexual behavior at home. We got some planning to do, you know? And it really has taken a lot of the pressure off, right? So what's happened is Sunday afternoons is typically where we'll spend some time together. And it's valuable to both of us. It's an important part of our relationship. But if it's a Sunday afternoon and I don't get home till late tomorrow night, y'all screwed up my whole week. But if it's Sunday afternoon and for some reason, you know, I'm kind of waiting on the signal, because we all know they got the keys to the car, and all of a sudden I hear the shower running, right? I go, well, what the hell? Because I know that means that, no, this time is, the store's closed. And I don't say anything. I just pout. But I'm being serious. I don't say anything. I'm too immature to say anything. So I just sit there in that silent scorn. I'm kind of disappointed and I'm ticked off. And then the phone rings and it's a sponsee and I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to answer. Or if I do, I'm short. Maybe my daughter calls. But I'm pouting, so my availability to other people, this is a sex problem. So I've broadened how I view what these things might turn into and how I get my feelings hurt or how, you know, whatever those things are. So it's just been it's refreshing for me to be able to take a look at that and put it in context of everything else that every other area of that self-examination, and it begins to tap down to stuff. So now I don't take that personally nearly as much. Now, Connie's more likely, or I'm more likely on a given day to say, you know what, I need a pass today, hall pass today, just, you know, not feeling. That's okay. But growing up and treating this area of my life like I do so many other areas of my life, like a real adult, and recognizing that we treat it like we would any other problem. And that's just been immensely helpful to me and helped me put things in their proper perspective and realizing that what I'm really trying to do is make sure that whatever my feelings are, whatever my behavior is in that area, is not cutting me off from God and cutting me off from you and impacting the relationships with the people closest to me. That's what it's about. It's about freeing me up so I can be of more use to you. And which is everything we're doing here in AA. So that's all I know about sex in 20 minutes.
So time for lunch. We're gonna. Am I correct in that? This is lunchtime. Okay. And we're gonna be back 4 o'clock, Malcolm. Right here. All right. You got any closing wisdom for us?
No closing particular wisdom, but some directions. go to your seats and grab your plates and walk on through and form a line like we usually do. For my logistics crew, after you've had your lunch, come on back in here, and we're going to reset this room so they can have their afternoon 2 o'clock meeting. We're going to leave the table and the risers set up, but we're going to reset all the chairs so they can have their afternoon meeting, and we can come back in here at 4 o'clock with a minimum of to-do and have our meeting. We've decided our volunteer fire department meeting at 7:30 tonight. We're going to do it outside the front of the meeting. So we're going to try to you know, add a little comfort to the evening meeting tonight. I think that's about it. At the afternoon meeting, at the 4 o'clock meeting, we're going to pass the hat. Okay? It's a pass the hat for the Wilson House. And all of the proceeds are going to be our donation as a group to the Wilson House. The finances of this event were based on a break-even of about 60 people. We didn't quite make it there. So our planned contribution isn't going to be quite what we hoped it would be. I want to make sure that people don't spend the rent money on this contribution. So if you can afford it, put something in the basket. And we certainly appreciate it. And we'll see you at 4 o'clock. The video that Chris and I made for the Zoom presentation is going to be running in the prayer and meditation meeting room, starting at 1 o'clock. And it's going to run all afternoon until 4 o'clock. It's 32 minutes, and it's going to run over and over and over again for the Zoom participants. So if you want to duck in there and see the video rather than make the tour, that's great. Thank you, everybody.